politics is a big interest at the print, and as we keep saying, because politics matters, that's why the print, because politics determines everything in our lives, particularly in a democracy. So what is central to the politics of the day is what National Interest is talking about today. Look at a few questions which have been buzzing. You've been watching on your TV screens, in your newspaper headlines, water cooler talk, as it's called in the office, when you go to some place, to the water cooler to fill up your water or maybe to a coffee dispenser. What is it that people are talking about? So a lot of the talk is about what's happening in Varanasi with the Shiva temple, Kashi Vishwanath temple, and the Gyanvapi mosque. And then again, what's happening now or might happen now in Mathura, etc., etc. So first of all, first question, is it a Shiva Lingam or an oversized fountain spout in the wuzu tank at Varanasi's Gyanvapi mosque? Boliye. Has the court-ordered survey found vermilion-covered idols, lotus, swastika, Sheshnag, which is the mythical-headed, multi-headed king of serpents, on the walls of the mosque? Answer the question. Does the mosque in the Qutub Minar precincts in New Delhi have an inverted slab featuring a Ganesha? Was the Shahi Eidgah Mosque in Mathura built by Aurangzeb after demolishing the Keshav Deva temple to mark the birthplace of Lord Krishna? Let's assume, therefore, the answer to all these questions is yes. Because it mostly is. Never mind the shivling fountain issue. Some people say it's cement, some say it's granite, and cement was only invented after 100 years after Aurangzeb died. But all that doesn't matter. In a sense, all of these are factually correct. So three further questions then arise. What are these questions? Number one, if all of these are true, how does it matter? So all of these are true, but how does it matter to us? Good question. Second, if it makes you, the Hindu majority, furious, what can you do about it in 2022 now? And if you are an Indian Muslim, angry and fearful, how do you respond? Because you will be angry and fearful and resentful. Now, as we explore answers to these life and death questions for Indian nationalism, we have to ask one more. So this question is, why does the Prime Minister of India, from Jawaharlal Nehru in 1947 to Narendra Modi from 2014 onwards, address the nation on Independence Day from the Red Fort or Lal Killa in Delhi? Delhi's Red Fort or Lal Killa is accepted as a symbol of India's sovereign authority and power across the political and ideological divide. Is it seen as a Muslim monument? Of course it was built by a Muslim ruler, but is it seen today as a Muslim monument? If that were the case, why would the Prime Minister of India, why would Narendra Modi, year after year, be addressing the nation from the ramparts of the Red Fort? It's a national symbol. Now, the early 17th century fort is a good symbol of the fascinating and intriguing complexities of the evolution of Indian nationalism over the past 300 years. Or let's dare to say, evolution of India's secular nationalism. How do we get there? Let me try and explain. Now, fully Indian Shah Jahan. There's no doubt that Shah Jahan was born in India to a Rajput mother. Fully Indian Shah Jahan ordered its construction, Red Fort's construction, in 1638 AD when he decided to move his capital from Agra to Delhi, which, by the way, I think was a great idea because Delhi has less worse weather than Agra, is less dusty than Agra. And also it is sort of more in the middle, given that the other power center for that empire was in Lahore. In 1638, he decided to shift the capital to Delhi. And that's when he ordered the building of the Red Fort or the Lal Killa. Now, even in the view of the hard Hindu right, Shah Jahan is seen as being among the least worst of the Mughals. He was also a victim of his quote-unquote evil son Aurangzeb, who killed his brother, that is Shah Jahan's favored son, Dara Shikoh, and also Shah Jahan's preferred successor, to usko marke. That is how Aurangzeb took over power and jailed his father as well. He imprisoned his father, who he dismissed as decadent, lazy, addicted to various things which were un-Islamic, things of enjoyment, which Aurangzeb disapproved of. Now, as we know, nothing is simple with our history. It was this less worse Shah Jahan who, by the way, ordered the destruction of the magnificent temples in Orchha because its ruler Jujhar Singh used to be loyal to him, he had now rebelled. There's a footnote there. The prince he sent on that punitive raid to Orchha was Aurangzeb, no other. Horses for courses, you see. If the Mughals are seen as foreigners by some wise people today, the first sacking of the Red Fort was actually carried out by a genuinely foreign Muslim invader. This was Nader Shah, who came in from Iran or Persia in 1739, about 100 years after Red Fort was built. The Mughal Empire was by now in vertical decline. I'd say so steeply in decline that it will be comparable with that Boeing 737 that went down in China in March. And apparently for some similar reasons, like seemingly for the Chinese pilots, the Mughal descendants of Aurangzeb were also often suicidal and they were then crashing their own empire. Nader Shah destroyed the decrepit Mughal ruler of that time, Muhammad Shah. He is of the famous Rangila or colorful suffix in popular history and classical music, Muhammad Shah Rangile. Apparently, he was also a great patron of music and art, wasn't so hot at fighting. So Nader Shah, after defeating him, destroyed large parts of the Red Fort, carted away most of its wealth, and most importantly, the peacock throne. Why did he do so? Red Fort wasn't a Hindu monument, nor housed a temple. It housed a mosque, in fact. Aurangzeb's one contribution to Red Fort was that he built the Moti Masjid there, among the very few things of any lasting value that Aurangzeb may have built. So it did not house a temple. It wasn't a Hindu place of worship. Why would Nader Shah treat it so rudely? Because it was a symbol of the once great Indian Empire's sovereign power. It was a Mughal empire, it was a Muslim empire, but he had to demonstrate that he had destroyed that power. That is how medieval conquerors flaunted their victories. He, that is Nader Shah, even as a fellow Muslim conqueror, had to sack it in style typical of medieval marauders. That's why he had to take away its Mughal throne. Now, next time the Red Fort was sacked, it was sacked not by other Muslim invaders or Hindus seeking revenge. It was now conquered by one of the warrior missiles, that is factions of the Sikhs. The legendary commanders of these missiles, that is Jassa Singh Ahluwalia, Jassa Singh Ramgadia, and Baghel Singh. They were hailed as heroes and are still hailed as heroes, not merely among the Sikhs. Jassa Singh Ahluwalia, in fact, is hailed as a national hero too. They led that venture. The Sikhs seized Red Fort. In fact, many people had harked back to that incident when the farmers' movement one day went out of control and people walked into the Red Fort and unfurled the Sikh religious flag there, and they said that is some 250 years after Jassa Singh Ahluwalia. So people talked about that. People see all kinds of things. In that case, the Sikhs returned with their sizable tribute because they were the victors. The privilege of basing a garrison in Delhi and restored Red Fort and whatever was left of the throne to another Mughal weakling, just as Nader Shah has done. Importantly, part of the deal for the Sikhs to leave the Red Fort and Delhi was the mandate to build 7 Gurdwaras in the city. That is when Gurdwara Seez Kanj was built in Chandni Chowk, where Emperor Aurangzeb had the 9th Sikh Guru Tegh Bahadur beheaded. Now, religion was essential to medieval conquest. You can see that. Prime Minister Narendra Modi, in fact, addressed a Sikh congregation on 21st April this year at Red Fort to commemorate the 400th birth anniversary of Guru Tegh Bahadur. And Red Fort wasn't done yet. The freedom fighters or mutineers, whatever you call them, fought in 1857 for Bahadur Shah Zafar and his flag, even though he was only a nominal ruler now. Shenshahe Alam, Dilli se Palam. That's what was said about him. He did not control any of India, but he was a symbol. So for the mutineers or the freedom fighters of 1857, the titular emperor and the Red Fort represented India's sovereign authority. That's why the last sacking of the Red Fort was carried out by the British once they had crushed the rebellion. If Nader Shah's was the most destructive by way of loot, this was the worst destruction of royal buildings. the British left nothing standing, almost nothing standing. Very little survived East India Company. The royal quarters, harem areas were all hammered into rubble, and ugly barracks were built there instead. Even later in 1945-46, the mutiny trial of captured soldiers of Netaji's Indian National Army, INA, was held at Red Fort. Why? Because symbolically, they had dared to take on the might or challenge the might of the great Indian state, the great Indian sovereign state, even though it was under the British then. That's why it was seen as the ideal venue for the trial to convey a message to the rest of the country. Now we have seen that between 1739 and 1857, or say within 118 years, 118 years, the Red Fort built by a Mughal suffered depredation at the hands of Muslims, Nader Shah, Sikhs, that is the Jassa Singh Ahluwalia and the missiles, and Christians, if you might describe the British of East India Company as such. The reason they were all fixated on this one landmark was that it symbolized India's state power, not because it symbolized a religion's power. Now, we had already accepted that the answers to all the questions we had raised initially about Gyan Vyapi, Mathura, Qutub Minar, that the answer to all of those was yes. That temples in Kashi and Mathura were demolished on Aurangzeb's orders, and a mosque and an Eidgah were built on the ruins. That fact is also recorded by historians seen by the Hindu right as quote-unquote devious liberal left. Now, Audrey Trushke, under attack for the supposed crime of quote-unquote normalizing Aurangzeb, acknowledges this. Richard Eaton of Arizona University, and widely respected for his magisterial work on medieval India, records this in detail. Now, you can read his book and other academic papers, but for simpler reading, you can also access this in his two-part essay in 2001 in Frontline magazine. Not just Mathura and Kashi, he lists numerous other temples and Hindu places desecrated since the arrival of Muslims, first as mere sack and loot invaders like Ghazni, then colonizers, and finally the mostly India-born and indigenized rulers, especially the Mughals. There is nothing new, therefore, that any court-mandated survey anywhere can discover. You can keep seeing those things on your TV screen. See, all with all those marker lights. See this lotus. See this swastik. All that doesn't matter, because it's telling you nothing new. Any amount of court-mandated surveys will not discover anything that is not known. This is all undisputed history. The three questions we asked earlier need addressing now. What do we do with this history? Once we accept the history, what do we do? So if there is no argument that these destructions did happen, what is left to fight over is the motive of the destroyers. One side thinks it was purely or mostly political and economic. That is what would be described today as the left liberal view of history. The other side believes it was pure religious bigotry, hatred for the Hindus, and violent iconoclasm. Now, that's a valid intellectual debate for scholars from both sides. It's also impossible to change this past under our existing constitutional structure. Let's be sure of that. The Places of Worship Act 1991 bars any such revisionism. To be sure, the 2019 five-judge Supreme Court judgment in Ayodhya has placed it unambiguously within the basic structures of the Constitution, and I had spoken about it in detail in a recent episode of Cut the Clutter. I can't see even a Modi majority junking this law and being so destructive of our own national interest. I don't think it's going to happen. 3 decades ago, Nelson Mandela gave us an idea as powerful as Mahatma Gandhi's Ahimsa, and more contemporary. This was the idea of truth and reconciliation. It follows that there cannot be any reconciliation without the truth. Time may have come in India for us, for Hindus and Muslims, to accept the truth and move towards reconciliation. How does it work? At this point in the 21st century, the Hindus can stop digging evidence of their victimhood in the past. That's well known and documented already. It's already available even from the sources the other side also considers credible. The Muslims and the left secular elites should similarly get over their denialism of the wrongs of the past, whatever the motives of the wrongdoers. It was wrong. It is self-defeating now to hang the secular causes on arguments like, was Aurangzeb a nice guy? No medieval ruler of any kind, any religion was a nice guy in 21st century terms. Some were just worse than others. Once both sides accept this truth, a slow reconciliation will be possible. Now, before I let you go, just a reminder. I know a lot of you watch our YouTube channel. Please take a membership. Doesn't cost you that much money. It's just 159 rupees a month. And there are many benefits in return for membership, which we keep listing, and some will be listed on your screen now. And one of these include the fact that when you respond to a video, the person who's hosting that video or who's featured in the video will answer any messages, any responses from you with great humility and with great gratitude. So please do take that membership.